Welcome to Straight Up, brought to you by Peak Prosperity, which values context, curiosity, and learning that leads to action. Reading from his latest works and expanding on current events in the economy, energy, and environment, it is my pleasure to introduce your host, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Straight Up. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and this is part two for subscribers. This one is called The Antidote to This Insanity. The Antidote to This Insanity, which is a follow-on to the Crazy Pills article that I wrote that's out there in the public sphere. And this is talking about taking your destiny into your own hands through direct action, because it's time. It is absolutely time to begin taking more action. You know this, I know this, and the question is, how and what do we do? Well, have you had your fill of crazy pills? You know, are you looking for that antidote? Of course you are. First, I want you to start by tuning out anything that's obviously wrong and or misleading. It's just simply not worth the mental energy to try and either refute or make sense of such inanity. By extension, limit your exposure to those who thrive on their daily allotment of crazy pills, or at least avoid the usual topics that start them ranting in their own directions. Look, we rant, they rant, but our crazy pills may be different from their crazy pills, but there are so many things out there in the public sphere, in the public narrative, that just don't make sense. They're nearly everywhere. I put in this article an example from the Wall Street Journal on the day that I was writing this article, and this was being written on Friday, July 26th. And it had two front page headlines. So this is Wall Street Journal. I get the hard copy of this, lands on my porch. I open it up right on the front page. Two front page headlines, one right on top of the other. The first headline is, Europe swelters as temperatures soar. And then there's a big graphic showing just how hot Europe is. And this isn't just a little bit of Europe. It's France and Spain and the UK and Germany, and it's Europe. And right under that is a headline that reads, ECB signals rate cut, relaunch of stimulus. Europe is suffering under both an intense heat wave and from a lack of rainfall for 2 years running. Power plants are shutting down to a lack of cooling water. So those are nuclear plants in France shutting down, not enough water to run them. River barge traffic's halted due to low river levels. Farms, terrible shape because of the combination of heat and drought. Yet you can read that entire article about the record-breaking heat and drought, and there's not one mention of a possible connection between these weather anomalies and economic growth. And just beneath the first is the second article about how the European Central Bank is busy doing everything possible to spur more growth into the European economy because it's terrified that inflation is too low. Well, that's what they say. If you can believe such nonsense, right? And there's not one word in that entire article about a possible connection between the ECB's efforts and their ecological consequences. In a world addicted to crazy pills, these are two entirely unconnected articles. One about all these weather-related anomalies, and the second about the absolute need for growth. We got to do whatever we can. But in the world that you and I inhabit, everything connects to everything else. And it leads to one of my favorite quotes. I've been using it for a decade in practically every talk I give. And it's from Leonardo da Vinci, who says, learn how to see. Realize that everything connects to everything else. We happen to live in a world of interconnected systems. Actions create results. Oftentimes, in many ways, we don't really anticipate. Why? Because complexity is the rule, not the exception. Complex systems have emergent behaviors, not linear outcomes. But there you have the ECB and the Fed all tugging furiously on their monetary levers, expecting things to behave predictably. They want linear outcomes, you know? They might say to themselves, well, if people borrow more when we tug this lever from 4% down to 3%, then that will also be true if we tug it from 0% to minus 1%. Nope, that's not how it works. Human behavior is not a linear function. So I want to talk about taking this seriously. Because if you know all of this stuff, right, you went through part one, saw all the crazy pills, ecologically, financially, economically, it's just tons of crazy stuff. So in the coming years and decades, there's going to be hell to pay for society failing to properly assess the risks and realign its priorities and activities accordingly. And there's not a lot you can do about any of it either. That's been my purpose in exploring the biological underpinnings as well as the limitations and realities of our genetic programming, right? Since humans are wired for optimism, we have a link there to the recent podcast with Tally Sherritt, and we strongly discount the future for the present, where I'm linking back to articles about free will. Well, then, if we're wired that way, short-term decision-making, well, that's what we're going to get. And unfortunately, right now, we need long-term decision-making because that's currently out of stock in today's society. You need to do what you can at your own personal level. As I'm fond of saying, when it comes to decision-making, I have great faith in individuals and almost no faith in groups. People I trust. Groups? Not so much. The larger the group involved, the more suspect it becomes. You know, I'll bet the founders of Google had the best of non-evil intentions when they began. But now the Google behemoth is busy spying for the government, helping to weaken and overthrow various foreign governments that are unfriendly to Western business interests, and helping to rig domestic elections. Two guys, hey, they did pretty good. Big, giant, powerful company becomes evil. I mean, stop me if you've heard that one before, right? So to take all this seriously means to do what Peak Prosperity member Brush Hog suggested in a recent comment that he left on the site. He wrote, quote, "Here's what you do. You prepare personally for the inevitable consequences of collective society's failure to confront any of those problems. If enough individuals like you prepare, then guess what you got? A collective response to the problem." And that's all you can do. Forget about trying to convince everybody about what they should do about the problems that you think are foremost on the horizon. The fact is, you really don't know what's going to happen, and you really don't know what to do about any of it, even if you did. You have ideas, you have opinions, and theories. Most importantly, you have the freedom to pursue your ideas, opinions, and theories. You can make your own life as resilient as possible, and maybe others will be inspired by your example and follow suit. End quote. I like that. I like that quote a lot. It's just right. You do what you can, you prepare as best you can, and if you do that, you become part of the solution, even though you aren't actively trying to be the solution in its totality. You do what you can. Taking this seriously means that you're preparing for a future where humans one day figure out that the planet is not an infinite waste sink, nor an infinite source of raw goodies. I mean, that day is well within the lifetimes of the average aged person today. Whether that revelation comes to humanity as an insight or comes via the pain route is of academic but little practical interest, right? Insight or pain, those are the two ways humans change. You know, either way it happens, right? At the current rate of insight development, it happens too late to offer anything but a rough landing. The model is simple to draw. These were drawn back in the 60s and 70s. It turns out everything that we know about, care about, buy, love, hopes and dreams, economic, everything, it's all a subset of the biophysical system. Everything. Period. Full stop. So I have here a chart, a diagram, actually, in the article, and it has a big green circle called the biophysical system, and inside of that, we have the source function where raw materials come in from the left. They get fed into the economic subsystem, and then another arrow coming out of that, which is the sink function, which is where the pollution and the waste and the high entropy mass and energy goes, right? So sources and sinks, and the economy's in the middle. And listen, if that system gives way by reaching some sort of a tipping point, well, then too bad. Your future now exists solely within that new temporary state of ecological or biophysical equilibrium. And such changes are happening all the time. The Earth came out of a glacial period all on its own, and humans were ready to leap into that new temporary climate equilibrium. you know, it was pretty hard to run a big agricultural sort of a model when there was a mile of ice here in New England where I live. 10,000 years ago, there was a mile of ice right where I'm sitting, right? Not much farming was going on. Hey, the ice left, and we had a very nice glacial till left behind, which turned out to be fairly rich in nutrients, and a lot of forest grew up. It was awesome. Whereas the ice might have left on its own from here, other changes by humans are self-inflicted. The largest desert in the world, the Sahara, it was once a verdant paradise, and then humans came along. So here's a quote from an article that reads, "Today, the Sahara Desert is defined by undulating sand dunes, unforgiving sun, and oppressive heat. But just 10,000 years ago, it was lush and verdant. So, what spurred the shift from woodland to wasteland? A new study suggests humans played a big role. Author David Wright, an environmental archaeologist at Seoul National University, says that as humans spread west from the Nile River 8,000 years ago, they brought with them sheep, cows, and goats that gobbled up, mowed down, and trampled over native vegetation. This transformed the landscape and altered the local climate." End quote. We see now a similar set of changes being inflicted on the Amazonian tropical rainforests. And past a certain point of clear-cutting, the hydrological cycle may be pushed irretrievably past a tipping point, and what was once lush may become a desert. That's the thought right now. You can read lots of articles about that. I've linked to a couple of them in the comments down below this article at the site at peakprosperity.com. But there's a thought out there that once you push past a certain point of deforestation, the hydrological cycle, which means the rain falls, it's taken up by the trees, they transpire it back into the air, that creates the humidity that then falls as rain. So that's the cycle. The water's being pulled in, it's raining, it's recycling. And once you cut enough trees down, that cycle is broken and it no longer rains. And as it doesn't rain, the vegetation doesn't grow. And then you have a different cycle. And next thing you know, you have a Sahara Desert. That cycle also happened in Portugal, where we know just several hundred years ago, they had rivers large enough in the Madeira region to float 2-meter logs down. They cut all those 2-meter logs down. They cut all those trees down. And now there are no streams there at all. You know, you couldn't float a 2-foot log, let alone a 2-meter log down most of the streams there. So this has happened over and over and over again. There's a hydrological cycle. We don't understand it. We break it. And then the next thing you know, you got a desert. And then what do you do? Or, you know, maybe the world pushes past a different tipping point and the climate spikes to plus 5 degrees Celsius, right? Or maybe that tipping point's already happened and there's not a damn thing we can do about it anymore, right? Nobody really knows at this stage. So the actions that we're going to take, because nobody really knows what's going to happen, well, all we can note that the fingers of instability are growing steeper and they're more laden with potential energy. And if you remember in the crash course, and then we also echoed it a little bit in Prosper, Adam and I, the fingers of instability refers to a body of work where scientists were trying to figure out complex systems. And one of the simpler complex systems to study, because you can model it, meaning you can put it into a computer, meaning you can run computer simulations, is a pile of sand, where you're dropping one grain at a time onto a pile of sand. It's growing taller and taller. Eventually, it reaches a certain point, and it slumps. Maybe a little bit, maybe catastrophically, but it slumps. And so the scientists are trying to figure out, can we predict both when and how much? Will it be a little slump or a big slump? And what they found was, even though they controlled the model, right? They designed the parameters around the sand grains. Even though they controlled the model, they still couldn't predict when or how much a pile of sand would slump. And what they discovered instead was that you could start to note what they called fingers of instability, which would be steeper areas would start to develop on the faces of this sand pile. And the more of these fingers of instability you had, these steeper areas, the more of those you had, the higher the chance or the probability, the higher the probability that you would get a slump sooner and it'd be larger. But beyond that, we can't really model complex systems. And you want to talk complex systems, there's nothing more complex than climate and weather. It's just is ridiculously complex. So many feedback loops, so many parameters, so many of them are as yet undefined. We don't really know what's going to happen. But the question I might have is, does it really matter if we humans wake up one day and decide to limit fossil fuels via insight, right? Because we're worried about the climate effects. Or we simply keep burning them until we run out or bake ourselves, right? We go the pain route, right? We just, you know, rip the oil out of the ground as fast as possible, so fast that we flare the natural gas associated into the night sky because we don't have time to capture that gas and do something useful with it. We're in such a rush. We just race through it all until we run out. Does it really matter? You know, one way or the other, we're going to have less of these fossil fuels. You can see that coming, right? So if you can see that coming and you know, it's either, listen, humans either decide not to take the oil out of the ground because we have insight around that, or we decide to just take it all to the ground fast as possible and we run out catastrophically at some point. We go the pain route. Doesn't matter. Either way, there's a future without oil. So what does that look like? What does that mean? What should you be doing to prepare for that? Those are the really important questions. Most people aren't asking those. So I would argue that as an intelligent and thoughtful adult, your actions today will be the same, independent of which path we take, insight or pain. And I'll be completely honest here. I don't like the direction of things. I'd prefer to live in a world of natural abundance, low pollution, rich community. But we're not there right now. So here's what I'm doing to get there. And here's what I think everybody should do to get there. First, plant a garden. I've planted as big a garden as I can, and I'm not living in my forever house right now, so it's not the biggest garden in the world. I plan to move someday and be in a place where I can grow a much larger garden, but I'm not there yet. But still, if you came to my house right now, you would see there's bushes, there's flowers, there's fruit trees that weren't there a year ago, of every sort on my property. I'm doing more all the time. There's stuff going in the ground all the time. Everyone should do this. The benefits are extraordinary. You know, I build soil depth and fertility and organic content with fanatical devotion. You can always be increasing the organic content. You know what I love? I love the worms I see now. That's my signature. Those are the apex species in soil, right? If you had a teaspoon of soil, there would be several billion organisms in that teaspoon. Little insects and bacteria, fungi, you name it. So worms are kind of like the elephants, if you will, of the soil. So when I see the worms, I know that I've got a healthy functioning ecosystem down there, and I do everything I can to feed them and make sure they're happy. And also, another idea here is to begin to explore how to recycle nutrients, especially so-called human waste. I mean, a lot of people, they cringe at that spot, but at least think about it. Explore the idea. Someday, everyone will be doing it. Using your pee and your poo. It won't just be for astronauts on Mars and movies anymore. That's my prediction. It's an easy one to make, too. Our waste is anything but waste in this story. And then eat as much as you can from your own organic efforts. The happy byproduct of all this is going to be you're going to be eating healthier food. You're going to live surrounded by beauty and abundance. We've got butterflies returning here. I'm eating really healthy food where I know everything that's gone into it. And I've got more to say about this coming up because I just did a podcast with Paul Wheaton, the permaculture guy. Thank you, all the people, David, especially, who recommended that we get him on the program. That was fun. And he really talks about how everything that we see as a problem or a predicament today can be addressed. And it all starts at the local level with things that you do on your own homestead. And that harkens back to Brush Hog's comment. We become part of a movement that achieves critical mass if we keep doing things. And this is about being intelligent. It's about using our brains to not be dumb in this story, right? Not be wasteful, not be extractive. The next thing you can do is you can become an energy producer. I've installed solar hot water panels. I have PV panels, not on my roof, but just some that I can charge things with outside in the back. I'm becoming adept at using that energy in as many ways as possible. There's a really rich vein of skill building to explore here. I would love to have the skill level of somebody like Mott's, remember Mott's at the site, who's just got way off the charts exploration and intelligence and experience around using DC electricity in particular. So there's just tons to learn there. So some basic questions like, can you use whatever solar PV you have to charge batteries? Do you know how to do that? I mean, what if the grid was down? A lot of people's PV systems work, but they're grid tied. When the grid goes down, they basically become bricks, right? So could you use your solar systems if the grid was down? Do you know how to complete basic wiring circuits, right? Do you know what a diode is? Right? These are all important questions to explore, fun little projects to play around with. Another thing you might do is use a solar oven. And I just started doing this just about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, yeah. And the results have been extraordinary, much better than anticipated. In the article, I've got a few pictures. I show the solar oven in operation. It's just a box. It's got these four mirrored stainless steel wings that fold out to direct the sun's rays down into this little black box with a glass cover on it. And what happens is it just cooks things extraordinarily well. Mostly I've just cooked meats in it so far. I throw chicken in there. I don't worry about it. I come back at the end of the day. It's cooked perfectly. It's moist as can possibly be. But it goes up to 320 degrees with liquid stuff in there. I bet it would go hotter if it was just something more like a bread or something like that. But anyway, everything I've done has turned out fantastically. Super moist, falling off the bone, very clean taste that I guess is because there's no heating elements burning up any residuals from the last meal, maybe, you know, even like dust on the electric coils in the oven. I don't know, but it tastes great. I've cooked pork ribs, chicken breasts, oil and rosemary. Excellent results every time. But here's the fun part. Not running an oven in my kitchen during July has its own benefits. But the energy savings are pretty obvious, right? I'm not overheating my house with an oven, and I'm not spending any energy at all to bake stuff. Just that's great. And as a final note, we're still using the dehydrator, which I've been talking about, and it gets loaded with whatever fell off the truck over at our local discount grocery store, The Barn, great place. We've been doing more bananas and just whatever is available over there. So dehydrating things. And my next plan is to build a solar dehydrator, because my current dehydrators run on electricity. So I think a solar dehydrator could work. My issue around it right now is a lot of the designs I've seen, you know, you set it up and it works, but it works at a temperature that is not regulated. So I want to look into temperature regulation as an idea, because some things you want to dry at a lower temperature, some at a hotter temperature. Jerky, very hot, but certain fruits at a much lower temperature. Next, using less energy. So I've used a state, it's a utility program we have here to re-insulate my home. Very cheap. Windows are next. I think I could get a big help from replacing some windows, particularly ones that are clearly breaking down right now. But already my energy bills are noticeably lower than last year. And I've begun to explore the idea of electric bicycles or maybe scooters as a means of transportation, or maybe just a bicycle for some applications. Maybe get a trailer for it. And if you do go this route, here's some questions to explore. How much can you pull? How much could you carry? Right? How many hills are between you and whatever shopping or entertainment you want to do? How much of the year is bicycle practical for you? Right? Because either it gets too hot or maybe too cold, depending where you live. And finally, the free hot water I get from my solar system, it feels like I'm using less energy here too, even though technically I'm using a lot of energy. It's just that the solar hot water system requires an almost undetectable amount of electricity to operate. And the rest comes from the sun, which is free. And then next up is building community. So after moving to a new location after my divorce, I started building a new community where I live. And one of the ways I did that is I joined the local sporting gun club and volunteered to undertake tasks really well suited to my skill sets. It's a fruitful club to join because there are a lot of people who share my core values, which include safety, personal responsibility and preparedness, and an eagerness to learn and improve, right? The people I meet there, they're all eager to learn and get better and improve. So it turns out that's a super important core value of mine because I'm doing that all the time. As it turns out, guess what? People don't just have those values in one of their hobbies. You know, they don't just save up their values, those values, or have a different set or bust them out only when they go do shooting, say. They have that hobby because they already had those values, right? So I think the people who are attracted to certain sports and activities are doing so because that's they align with how they're already constructed. And without being pushy about it, I'm working my way into the club culture. Every group of people has a culture. I'm working my way in. I'm opening up more and more. Yes, I'm being open and taking some conversational risks, but that's the quickest way to sort things out. You know, so it's not everybody there is going to be a perfect match for me, but by being open and allowing myself to really say who I am, I'm finding the people within that culture very quickly who there's a good fit with. Well, I guess what I found? A lot of people there who happen to already know on whatever level that the world's headed in the wrong direction. And they're interested in discussing that and figuring out what to do about it. So this is a really rich club in terms of meeting the sorts of people I already wanted to meet. The biggest accelerant for me was when I stuck my hand up and volunteered to chair a committee exploring what to do with a very out-of-date indoor range. The lead contamination was off the charts. This was a grandfathered facility, probably put in before people understood what lead contamination was, and had been in operation for a long time. So it was part of the club culture to have this facility. Well, all of a sudden it occurred to some people there that maybe they had to look into this from a liability standpoint, who wanted to head up that particular committee. And it turned out that it was a very complex job. And so volunteers and complex pieces of work turn out to be usually a fairly poor mix. So I stuck my hand up, said, you know what, I think I could lead that. You know, no worries. My PhD is in neurotoxicology, so figuring out the toxicology issues, well, that was easy enough for me. That's easy. I know how to read those papers. We also had a gentleman there who stuck his hand up with 40 plus years of professional experience working at UMass handling toxic waste. So he knew all the ins and outs of that super complicated regulation-rich arena. We also had builders, HVAC professionals, numerous other professionals to tap. So together, we had all the skills we needed. And one of the things I loved when I was at a Robert Kiyosaki event, it was down in Mexico City, and Adam and I were both there, and there was a really great demonstration experience that happened, which I loved, where this guy got up, not Robert Kiyosaki, but one of his advisors was leading this group, about 800 people in the room. And he said, oh, you know, I'm going to talk to you all about entrepreneurship, but first, there's going to be a pop quiz. Here's how this is going to work. Everybody get out a piece of paper and a pencil. There's going to be five questions. I'm going to ask you these five questions. You're going to have a fairly limited amount of time to write down an answer. And then once I'm done with the fifth question, you're going to hand your piece of paper with your answers to the person to your left, and they are going to grade your test. Ready? Go. Room goes dead quiet. 800 people. Just all you hear is the rustling of paper and pens, you know, the clicking of pens. And he shouts out the first question. He's like, what was the price of gold yesterday? Who is the second vice president of the United States? Just random things, right? People are writing stuff down. We get to the fifth question. He says, stop. Listen, don't hand your papers to the left. I don't care about what your score here was. That wasn't the point. The point was that you all were trained within a school system. So I tapped into that training. I told you you were going to take a test. You already have that pattern written into your habits, into your practices. You all went quiet. You all started probably worrying about, could you get the right answers? You were probably already in your head thinking, oh my gosh, what if I get the wrong answer? And oh, who's the person to my left that's going to see how dumb I am? He said, you have this whole script running. But notice I didn't say that you had to answer these questions by yourself. I didn't say that you couldn't talk to somebody else and ask them around. He said, I guarantee you that somewhere in this room, there was an answer to every single question I could possibly ask. And that's entrepreneurship. Understanding that out there in the world, after you leave school, there are no rules that say you have to get the right answer all by yourself. That's school. In real life, we get teams of people around us and we understand that the answers we need are already around us. And that's real life. School doesn't train us for real life. It trains us for this artificial thing, which is all about there's a right answer at the front of the room. Your job is to be able to access rapidly the part of your brain that stored the correct answer so you can get recognized for that. So lesson here is that the answer is always in the room. All right. Sorry for that diversion, but let me get back into it. So that was I'm bringing that level, that sort of experience into this, and knew that in a club of 400 people, we had all the experience we needed to handle this. And at the end of this, we had to come up with a presentation so that the club could make a decision for, as I said, 440 plus members. And to illustrate it, I had to create a decision tree with, you know, each path having its own costs and regulatory implications. It's a fairly complex thing. In the article, I showed this decision tree, and there's a lot of paths on this thing to make that decision. And at any rate, having undertaken such a potentially incendiary, because guess what? Not everybody was happy with the idea that we might lose. And we probably are going to lose our indoor range to the idea that it's too expensive to fix. And far too expensive to replace. So, and we can't operate it as is. So there you go. So, but to have done that work and to have done a difficult piece of work earned a lot of goodwill. And it's also worth noting here, another lesson learned is that even what seems to be a relatively simple decision in this day and age of late stage empire, where there's just rules and regulations and all of that to deal with, but also to really understand anything, including lead toxicity, or, you know, are we breaking the hydrological cycle by running a few too many sheep in this part of the of our land? Everything's complex. And so it was interesting to watch how a group of people began to struggle with a fairly complex question, which is fairly simple. Should we close or modify our existing range? Simple question. Turned out it's fraught with complexity. Just the issues of liability and regulations are complex. Now, I don't think any of that's going to improve before the great simplification, right? Where a lot of those liability and regulation sort of things go away because we can't afford to maintain such a complex infrastructure as we currently have arranged for ourselves. So, thinking this through further, though, so that was just a little aside about how I'm building community, just in case that helps, clarify or raise any sort of make light bulbs go off for anybody. But some questions I need to still explore about community are, first, what's it going to be like trying to live with people once times get tough? You know, look, I know that when we have resources and times are relatively flush, people behave one way, but when times get tough, then what happens, right? We can only imagine, you know, the stress of the future is going to make that a little bit more difficult. Second question is, do I imagine people potentially living here with me on my property? Or will I go to some other place to live with other people? And if that happens, well, what agreements would have to be made? Actually, in either situation, what agreements? Would we have agreements? What would they look like? How do other communities handle this? Another question would be, well, how different will it be to go from being head of a small household to being part of a group, but probably a group under a lot more stress? Which for me raises the question, is it even possible at this stage of my life for me to enjoy living in close proximity to other people after a lifetime of living as part of a single nuclear family? You know, related question, maybe I should just buy a tent. You know, I don't know if I can do the whole commune thing. I kind of doubt it at this point. And my final question here is, what skills am I missing? And how would I develop them? So I'm actively exploring these and many other questions, but I already know one thing for sure. Sharing values is what matters the most. Agreements can be made, sure, but under pressure, those will crumble and you're left with the values that lie beneath. I happen to value hard work, doing more than my share, picking up after myself, being open and curious versus responding and reacting owning my own shit. I value honesty over delicate wordsmithing. I like to rapidly explore options. Other people, they're built differently. And that's neither good nor bad, but it is worth noting. I'd do poorly in a community that valued processing and delegating during times I thought called for doing and personal responsibility. And the stress of living in a community with different values, I don't think it'd be worth it to me. Other people are just built exactly opposite from me. And that's perfectly fine. I'm really good friends with people who cannot stand any sort of movement until there's complete group unity. I just don't happen to live in tight community with any of them, right? So the conclusion here is you're going to have to take a lot of crazy pills if you want to buy into the current narrative of endless growth, somehow being separate from ecological destruction. That's the front page of the Wall Street Journal. You got to take a lot of crazy pills to separate our those two connected, highly interconnected, all things are connected. Our economic policies and activities are connected to the ecological impacts of all of that. But you got, you know, you want to live in this culture, those two boxes, they shall not touch, you know, for the most part. The only antidote I know to combat any of that is direct action on your homestead, even if your homestead is a rental apartment in a city. However you can do this, you're going to build soil, you're going to plant things, lots of things. You're going to think about nutrient cycles. You know, you might break out a map of your local area from the late 1800s and ask the question, where were the settlements? That'll go a long way towards answering the question, where are the most energetically and ecologically favorable areas to live? You'll probably notice that people settled along valleys and rivers, right? Deer make similar paths along the contours in the land. Those scents going up and down if you can avoid it. Where we're living today, for the most part, are in places that are deeply energetically unfavorable. We do it because we have 500 billion, with a B, billion energy slaves on a daily basis operating for us, dragging our butts up and down over mountain valleys and into odd places. And today there are people who live on mountaintops with steep hills between their houses and their work and shopping, travel, all of that stuff, right? Maybe you're one of them. Ask if that's where you want to be, if when energy or food becomes scarce. Maybe yes, maybe no. Depends on the situation. I keep pointing out all the ways that all of this is unsustainable, especially economically and ecologically and very soon energetically, but the message is falling on deaf ears. They, quotes, they have done a masterful job of controlling the narrative by jamming stocks ever higher, distracting people with truly meaningless trivia and faux emotional issues. And to read the mainstream news right now in the U.S. and to listen to the mainstream politicians, you'd think far and away the most pressing topics today pertain to gender identity issues and which new groups should get the money hose pointed at them next. These issues aren't even remotely at the top of my list of priorities. Building out a brand new energy infrastructure, having a clear plan for how we're going to not lose the last 6 inches of topsoil from the Midwest into the rivers and putting it into our gas tanks in the form of ethanol, figuring out exactly how we're going to behave in a world where resource scarcity is going to begin to dominate and beginning to conserve as much as possible, figuring out how to build in ways that both support the human experience and make sense in a world where we know energy's running away. Don't build any more things that are going to designed to crumble in 40 years, like most of the houses and commercial buildings going up, right? They're no good after 40 or 50 years. They're beautiful, flat glass fronts, flat roofs, flashing, water seeps in. Hey, we got to replace the whole thing. You know, there is a pub in Ireland that's been operating continuously since the year 900. Continuously. Still standing. Look, there are ways we know how to build where buildings can last 1,000 years. We ought to be doing that again. That would be a project I would be so behind. Unbelievable. Those are my priorities and very much not aligned with the distractive diversions that are going on in mainstream press in the U.S. Again, this is not surprising, especially at a critical time such as this when our most central economic narrative of growth is now set against our long-term best interests. That's crazy making, right? You either confront that head on and take actions that align your inner integrity with your outer actions, or you gobble crazy pills and pretend it's all going to work out somehow. I'm glad to be on the rational, sane side of the ledger with you. And that brings us to the end of this piece. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you next time.